so that people remember that beyond the discussions, beyond the policy, the statistics, there are faces all the way out here. There is a baby stomping squeaky yellow light-up shoes across the edge of a reef, not yet underwater.
Okay. That was Kathy Jetnell-Kitchener of the Marshall Islands. And that does it for our broadcast. A very special thanks to our local crew here in Marrakesh. Rania Khader, Danya Nader, Phil Hasty, Mohammed Shama, Sean Russell, Ahmed Galal, Amr Yassin, and Fatima Zahra. Happy birthday, Fatima. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Noreen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Nardina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Shereen Andur, Andre Lewis. Special thanks to Nicole Salazar, John Hamilton, Dennis Moynihan, Renee Feltz, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee, engineers. Special thanks to Miriam Barnard, Rob Young, Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us from Marrakesh, Morocco.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. Today is November the 18th, 2016. Thank you for tuning in and listening. We are local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. If you're listening on the podcast or somewhere else in the world via the internet from our website, whfr.fm, of course, we're Dearborn, Michigan, United States of America. I have, as my co-host today, John Conroy, back from a little absence last week. Welcome back, John.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jay. There
yes.
we go.
Okay.
It's very fine to be back.
Okay, yes. And I'm sure John has some opinions about the election that we might hear after our special guest gets a chance to be grilled by us. And that special guest is Dr. Anthony Perry, who is a political science professor here at Henry Ford College and has been involved with several interesting initiatives on campus, student political forum. And in general, he's a coordinator of many other events that he will explain later after we get done with our election-related questions. Coordinator of the Democracy Institute. Very impressive. We'll just call you Tony, since you can call me Jay. So, I actually had one guest. I was interviewing local candidates for office, and the guest criticized me as not knowing much about politics. And it is true, I started out that interview mentioning I've only had one class of intro political science in college, officially. So that's my background. And it started with my professor, who was the head of the department at Oakland University at that time, and a doctorate and all that. And he said, first thing I'm going to tell you is that political science is an oxymoron. There's nothing scientific about politics until after the elections are over. And then you get busy trying to do analysis and looking at things logically and doing research and so on. And so that's why I guess, although you just weren't available last week, Tony, but you were very busy, I'm sure, trying to explain the election to other people. And so we stumbled in without your background. But now there's time for a little bit of analysis and perspective, I think, also about the political system, which, of course, you teach and know very well, or at least much better than I do, as I was criticized. I think it was, I didn't know the difference between socialism and communism or something, which I think I did. But anyway, nonetheless. Welcome. We just want to jump right in terms of, I just think it's kind of ironic is that in terms of the presidential race and the election in Michigan for president, we're the only state in the United States right now that the Associated Press that usually does this has not awarded victory to either Clinton or Trump. Even though there is a popular vote, although the vote is still not done being counted yet. So can you sort of explain that to our listeners, why we're not a blue, we're not a red state officially yet?
There's really two factors there. One is how close the election is in Michigan, with 11 to 12,000 votes being the difference between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And right now, Donald Trump has that advantage. And the second thing has to do with the certification of all of the cities and precincts across the state. You pretty much know what the outcome is, but you may have to certify those results, especially depending on the number of absentee ballots and possibly provisional ballots. And if there's challenges at another office on a ballot and there's a recount, then that plays a recount into those other offices as well. So that's all it has to do with. We should know and have this certified probably within the week.
In terms of recounting, let's say, the presidential vote in Michigan, that would be a big ordeal. But the Democratic Party, if Hillary loses, certainly could ask for that recount, and they would pay, it's not too much. Well, I guess it is. I don't know how many precincts are in Michigan altogether, but something like $125 a precinct to do that recount. And that would hold things up for a while in Michigan, too, wouldn't it, to recount the entire state?
It could be done a lot faster than when we used punch card ballots, because, you know, on the other hand, there would be no point in doing that because it wouldn't change the results of the Electoral College. I mean, Hillary Clinton, what it appears to is that she could win by as many as 2 million votes, the popular vote.
In the whole country, yes.
However, she's substantially lower in terms of the electoral votes, and therefore, for them to say, let's do an electoral recount. Now, obviously, if Pennsylvania and Wisconsin in particular, those states had similar numbers and there was a chance that the results could change, then they might call for it. But in essence, all this would do is add more animosity and angst to the election outcome than there already is. And that would be kind of detrimental to even the electoral process. So I think that part of the reasons why you would have seen it by now if they were going to do that.
I thought it was interesting when I read the rule that in Michigan there would, if the total vote for president, let's say, was closer than 2,000 votes, 2,000 or less, the state would do the recount for free. It would just trigger it automatically. Kind of interesting. But I understand, like in the year 2000, when it was Gore versus George W. Bush, it was really the crucial state was Florida. And of course, just a couple of precincts, I think, in the state too. Or was it all the hanging chads, again, of the punch card ballots?
Well, part of it was the hanging chads, and part of it was the butterfly ballots. So people were thinking they were voting for one candidate and were voting for the other because of the way that the ballot lined up. With the process of that manual machine, there are many more errors that can occur. And it was a very close election. And in the couple counties where they did recount, Gore gained an advantage. And the one thing that the Democrats tried to do was, once they saw that, let's try to recount the rest of the state. And this is a very time-consuming process because you have election inspectors looking at every ballot. And if a challenge is to the results, they are you'll have multiple challenges. Is this a vote or is this not a vote? Is the indentation indicate a vote or does it indicate that the person was not going to vote for that person? And that would have sent the election into the Electoral College would have ended up not having the 270 required or the majority required, and therefore the House of Representatives would have chosen the president.
Let's shift to some of the local elections, especially in Dearborn. I talked about these last week based on numbers I got from the Dearborn City Clerk's office. I don't know if any happened to draw your attention. It was somewhat interesting that the 19th District Judgeship in the area, people thought that Susan DeBaggia, current council president, had won, but that the city clerk's office that issued numbers that it did state in the small print does not include absentee ballots. And so Gene Hunt did a concession speech that night at his campaign facility and went home thinking he'd lost. And the next morning, it only took actually a couple more hours, that the clerk's office had counted then the absentee ballots. And it was something like absentee ballots were large in Dearborn, like 9,000-10,000 votes out of about 30,000 or 40,000 total, 40,000 total in Dearborn. And he won 2-1 in the absentee ballots, rather than sort of the 50-50 split that the numbers seemed to imply before when DiBaggio won. And she finally lost by only about 400 or 500 votes.
The absentee ballot in Dearborn Heights and many of our local communities has been always substantial, and you can never take the poll results without the absentee, unless you had, for instance, you know, you're winning by 40% coming out of the general. Even there, absentees can be actually more, depending on if it's an off-year election or not, because the absentee ballots include seniors that always vote often and people that always vote, and it shows an intensity. And also that often speaks to the campaign, because if your campaign is really focused on the AV vote, they're basically starting election day ahead.
A month earlier.
And you know, if we look at the city of Detroit, Mike Duggan really took advantage of the AV vote in the senior centers in Detroit, and that gave him the victory, many believe, because he was so well organized there, and those were people that were definitely going to show up.
To me, that's fascinating about the absentee voting, because I live downriver. I live on Gros Isle, where, again, the absentee voting has gone up and up and up. Do you see that as a continuing trend, that the absentee voting will continue to grow?
I think the trend of the growth has to do with two things. One is that the rules governing absentee ballots has been loosened. At one point, you had to be over 65 or not capable of going to the polls, or you're going to be out of town. And obviously, this was not necessarily checked, but people used to follow that. Today,
They've made it easier.
Now, of course, they've had early voting in some communities, like in Dearborn Heights. They've had the Saturday before the election where you could go to City Hall, mm-hmm. and it was a precinct, but you were really absentee balloting.
Yeah, they did that in Allen Park, my daughter tells me, too.
And also, the longer the deadlines are to register, that seems to bring, that can bring more voters into the fold.
Well, we haven't changed the deadline for registration in Michigan. It's still been 30 days. Okay. Some states have actually same-day registration, so you have anybody who's eligible to vote being able to vote in those cases. So we don't have that situation here. But one of the reasons why they went to early voting through absentee was to reduce the volume on election day, so that the polls could handle it.
Okay.
And that would have been almost essential if we had gone away from the straight party ballot. The U.S. District Court and the Circuit Court upheld and the restriction on moving and eliminating straight party ticket voting in Michigan. And the concerns that many communities had was that was going to make voting times a lot longer, because you would add the number of people that had been voting straight party ticket. Now they have to vote for every single office, and that adds time in the election booth.
Yes.
Two other things that are local in terms of voting outcomes, and we'll look at some other issues, of course, in general about our system, in fact. But last week I misspoke. Ismail Ahmed, nickname Ish, he lost for his race to be on the Michigan State Board of Education. I might have just been looking at either early numbers or just maybe Dearborn numbers. And also John Austin, who was a Democrat who came out about a month and a half, 2 months ago, with a major statement from the State Board of Ed about LGBTQ rights. And especially, you know, of course, bathroom access and other things. It's hard to say, but I would say maybe they lost because a lot of Republican state party voting, because the state board of ed races are pretty far down. So maybe had something to do with straight party voting, which automatically would choose those candidates for the state board of ed. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. But
well, part of it is that what we saw that led to really a Trump victory, the first time a Republican has taken the state of Michigan since 1988, when George Herbert Walker Bush won Michigan as the president, is that we saw a lot of registered voters who were what we call out county or in rural areas and so forth, actually show up that normally didn't. They were not likely voters, so this wasn't picked up in the polls. And the way they voted was traditionally Republican. And many of these people had not voted in the past in a general election that would have been held for president. We would see that those results of the Democrats losing the state house or the state board of education, possibly more likely in a gubernatorial election where voter turnout is much less. Mm-hmm. It's usually 40-42%, and that's part of the reasons why the Republicans control the governorship and both houses and even the courts. And we saw basically the impact of the turnout in those areas higher than the urban areas in a normal presidential election this year. So that impacted it.
The Metro Times this week has an article by Tom Perkins, again pointing out what I already knew, and I think you know easily why this happened. But both in 2014 and 2016, this current election, Democrats in Michigan received more votes in the state house races. Yet Republicans hold a huge 63-47 majority. And that's, of course, because of gerrymandering. Otherwise, you would think that there would be more, a higher percentage, or certainly a higher number of Democrats in the state house races. Of course, they didn't reelect all the state house positions this time. I mean, it was only a certain number that were, you know, term limited, like George Durrani locally, that had to be elected. So some were already there.
Correct. Every 10 years we take a census, and based on the census numbers, we have to redraw the districts to make them equal in size, or relatively equal in size. And the party in power in the state legislature determines those redistricting. They have the main role there. And they can draw them however they want, as long as they are not redistricting them based on racial reasons. They can do it for political reasons. And we've seen this trend over the last two decades, and it really has been exacerbated in the last decade.
I'd like to let our listeners know that we're interviewing right now and receiving important election analysis and commentary from Dr. Anthony Perry, political science professor here at Henry Ford College. I wanted, Tony, I get to say now the friendly first name, could you comment briefly about pro and con the Electoral College versus popular vote? Obviously, Donald Trump, clearly, as you said, has won the Electoral College numbers, and he is president-elect. But the popular vote, Hillary Clinton nationally will probably win, if you will, or have a 2 million vote majority in that. Should it be changed or eliminated? Give me your feelings as a political scientist. Obviously, it's not easy to eliminate something that's in the Constitution.
No, it's very difficult to change the Constitution. It requires 2/3 of Congress and 3/4 of the states to ratify a constitutional amendment. And we have to first and foremost understand why the Electoral College was put in place. And there's a lot of reasons that are given, but and what I believe from all of my historical analysis of the political system is that this was done to silo corruption. So states were very strong when we built the current Constitution, and no states wanted to give up that power, and they feared a tyrannous national leader. And what would happen because of the division both ethnically and culturally within the states is a state like Virginia could have their favorite native son, maybe Thomas Jefferson, win exceptionally big, 99% turnout. And that could, if you had a popular vote, that could ripple through all the states. Mm. Whereas a state like, you know, Massachusetts with somebody like John Adams, that would have less of an impact even if they corrupted it. So by siloing it by winner take all, the even if you only had, you know, one or two corrupt states, that would not impact the other states. So I think that there was a corruption reason built into going with a popular vote, not just we don't want the popular masses. The popular masses makes a lot of sense, but I actually think that when you're dealing with the states run the elections, there is no national election. Mm-hmm. There is a reason for it. And that's the rules of the game. And all the candidates and campaigns run that way. There, no one was campaigning in California. Everybody knew that Hillary Clinton was going to win California. Nobody was campaigning in Wyoming. They were raising money in these states, but you knew the results. So they focused on the various states. So there's advantages and disadvantages to changing any rules. But like any rules of a democratic or political system, the rules make every bit of difference. And you can look back at it and say, well, the reasons why, you know, Donald Trump won was because of the Electoral College. Yes. But on the other hand, the campaign would have been completely different if you didn't have the Electoral College. So it's sort of the counterfactual. If you didn't have the Electoral College, would Donald Trump ever have been elected president? Maybe. He may have campaigned completely differently without an Electoral College.
Well, even Donald Trump, though, a few years ago, before he got into running for politics himself, criticized the Electoral College and thought it should be done away with. If he's such a smart guy, then according to himself, then you'd think there'd be something into that. I caught this article, which I wasn't aware of this initiative, that some group nationally has come up with. It's called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, and their idea is to abolish, actually to take away the power of the Electoral College, not to abolish it, without having to go through the amendment process or having an amendment to reject the amendment or whatever, to abolish the amendment. And apparently it would be a matter of individual states, I assume, voting in their legislatures, maybe signed by the governor. I don't know the details on that. But as of November 9th of this year, 10 states in the United States and the District of Columbia have already signed on to this National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, and they've already got, therefore, they represent 165 electoral votes. And of course, you need 270 to win, or 270, I guess, to take away the power of the Electoral College to decide the winner. And what this, and they say that once it reaches 270, if the states, all these states agree to the same thing, they're going to wait to send their people to the Electoral College until they find out who the popular winner nationally is, and then send all those people to Electoral College to vote that way. I think I understand that, and just an interesting initiative. I don't know if it would ever hold up ultimately, but
well, the challenge with that would be if there's a contested election, the Constitution still requires the Electoral College. So if they held up their electoral votes and there was a contested election in terms of popular vote because it was very close,
right,
then the House of Representatives would choose the next president.
Right, if a certain number of states went to a recount.
So then mm-hmm. It doesn't really work. So, in theory, it works most of the time. But do you want to put something in place that could really go haywire? We're holding back our votes mm-hmm. because it's such a close election.
And of course, all opinions on the show are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford College, although Anthony's opinions are his, and he's here, and I'm here too, at least as adjunct faculty. So, but I would assume that the people in power, including the Republicans right now, who got the presidency thanks to the Electoral College, they're not going to start an initiative in the House and the Senate to pass Electoral College elimination, because they got there this way.
Maybe. I mean, well, the
they're busy with some other things.
They're busy with some other things. But the biggest challenge isn't that. The challenge is that it requires 2/3 of both chambers, mm-hmm. and then it requires you have to basically get 3/4 of the states to ratify it within 7 years to be a constitutional amendment. Right. So the bar is pretty high to do a constitutional amendment. It's not just passing a law.
People may remember the Equal Rights Amendment that would have benefited women primarily. That went down, and that seemed to be a slam dunk, and women were in the majority. However, we did do a couple of interesting constitutional amendments already to give women the right to vote, for example, as well as eliminating or establishing the popular vote as a way to get senators. It has been done in the past, but the time has to be right, I guess. John, did you have a comment?
Yeah, two thoughts. When was the last time that the House of Representatives chose a president, I guess, is the question.
Thomas Jefferson, and we had a lot of problems with that because we had the different rules between the vice president and the president, and they changed the rules when they passed the 12th Amendment to address that. Part of this has to do with, first past, sort of the winner-take-all system, where in which the Electoral College normally can choose them. And but we've had changes to the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Nebraska actually allocates its electoral seats based on congressional district. So Donald Trump only got 3 of 5 electoral votes in Nebraska, even though he won the popular vote by a lot. And that was one of the things that...
Those states just don't have the numbers.
They did it by precincts, not by the state totals.
They did by congressional
districts, not by state totals.
And the interesting thing here is that that was a policy that was being advocated. Mm-hmm. But once again, these electors, although they're asked to be bound to the popular vote within the state or now within Nebraska, within the congressional district, mm-hmm. There have been times when they have gone against that. In fact, in 1976, there was a lone person, I believe from Oregon, who was an elector who voted for Ronald Reagan instead of Gerald Ford. Hmm. But obviously that didn't have an impact because, Jimmy Carter won that election.
Although maybe on his own political life, because the people that appointed him made sure he never got a job again in that organization. But
well, usually the people that are chosen as electors have been long-term party loyalists that you pretty much are.
Already got a pension. He's retired. So.
Yeah, they're not. This is sort of an honor. It's not and you can really depend on them as opposed to somebody that's,
You're saying retirees are more dependable as far as
absolutely, John. Right. Look at us. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Well, we want to give you time to talk about what's happening at political science at the college. Boy, I've learned a lot. And obviously, anyone that wants to know more about politics from historical and a organizational point of view, need to take a class in political science. I know it sounds crazy, but it actually is a way to get education. And I'm making a very satirical joke there, but it is very interesting. I probably should have taken more than just that first political science class, I guess, but I was a little scared out by that first statement by the professor, but there's really no science in it at all. But Tony, you're involved with a lot of initiatives as well as teaching political science classes, but did you want to talk about the political science course offerings or a little more about maybe your student issues forums you handle each year or the Democracy Initiative? Well, you've got a big 5 minutes before you have to run to another meeting, I know, so go for it.
Thank you, Jay. We have a lot of courses in political science, and we use scientific methods and quantitative analysis as political scientists to try to objectify what we're looking at as opposed to looking at everything based on either theory or our own bias. So, and that really does help us find ways to look at situations in a less biased way. If mm-hmm. the data points one way, sure. But we had originally looked at our own viewpoint only and not looked at the data, we might be going in the wrong direction. So that's where the term science comes from. It's about using quantitative analysis to address political issues, to understand where people are, how they're acting, and so forth. But it's not perfect, nor is any science. Medicine is considered a science, but they call it practice. So
successful, hopefully.
Yes, hopefully.
Yeah.
We're getting better at it.
Yeah.
One of the things that we try to do here at Henry Ford and collaborate with our colleagues at institutions around the state, as well as nonprofit groups and other groups that are involved in the political realm, is to bring politics and make it real for the students. So we do a lot of activities under our Democracy Institute Consortium umbrella, including an annual Student Political Issues Convention, where students develop an agenda of issues that they think are the most important. And then they ask elected officials to tell them how they plan to solve them, mm-hmm. as opposed to just being talked at by elected officials and showing them that they have a political voice. And they, we usually get 700-plus students from around 10-plus colleges and universities here in southeastern Michigan who send students and participate. They develop workshops and get engaged. And we've been doing that for the last 14 years.
I want to say 10, but yeah, so, 14. I know, yeah. it's a great success, and it's very important to get everybody both the knowledge and the involvement in the political system, because if democracy is going to work, almost by definition, people have to get involved, not just vote, but get involved.
They do. Everybody talks about our rights as citizens in a democratic society, and I always try to emphasize to my students that we have responsibility. We are a big check on government. We often talk about the checks and balances of the institutions of government, but if we just acquiesce our power as democratic citizens, and acquiescing our power is not voting, it's not voting and voting intelligently. We're not just exercising our vote. We have to do our homework. We have to do our research and find out who's going to best represent our concerns and our issues. And quite often, the news media and falls into the trap of it's a black or white. It's a yes or no answer. And a lot of these issues are very gray. They're complex. And we get two talking heads on, and you're from one side, you're a Democrat or you're a Republican. And quite often, it's not just a Democrat or a Republican. It's the nuance that's really important. And, you know, when you have a 30-second answer that you can give to a question, that doesn't help. And that doesn't help the democratic process. It doesn't help educate our citizens to make informed decisions. So we've got to do a lot more.
Yeah,
and
even
that's what we're trying to do.
Even on non-commercial media like WHFR, I feel guilty only giving 30 minutes to a candidate or to yourself to try to explain a number of things that are very complex and actually have a lot of historical background and a lot of different points of view. And the assessment of the bigger picture is really important for as many people as can get involved in it. Just folks, a little word, a little suggestion from Jay Koronick. Don't get your news from Facebook, okay? I mean, please, that's probably not the best choice. And probably not from any even biased, and I have to say biased because it's a part of their marketing plan, but a biased cable TV news network, whether it's Fox News, where supposedly 77% of the population watches Fox cable TV news, or MSNBC, which they very carefully market towards liberal, not necessarily progressive, but liberal point of view. It's just bad to only get that one opinion. I'm using the word bad, and that can have all kinds of meanings. But that's definitely a problem in our society, is that the flow of news. And remember, these are commercial news networks, which means they always need more listeners or viewers, which means they have to sensationalize as much as possible to keep you tuned in. So they got to rile up your emotions as often as possible, so you're mad as you know what, and you're not going to take it anymore. And the only way to answer the problem is to keep watching that same medium, or get involved with those same people, because a certain talking head is your friend because he or she are saying the same thing over and over. And so you get sort of into a little box there. Well, we know that political science and college in general, the Church of Reason, I heard it referred to one time. We're here to open up people's minds to as many ideas and perspectives with critical thinking involved, of course, and to let them choose based on that. So it's as noble as you can get. We're not here to make anything emotional. And if we have biases, I'm sure everybody does, but we try to, at some point we may have to announce them, admit them, but basically our studies, our science part, that's not what that's about, So congratulations on all your initiatives here on campus and all your teaching in the political science area. You've actually taught here how long, Tony?
Since 2004.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So longtime professor, Dr. Anthony Perry. You can find out more about the political science area, of course, at the website, hfcc.edu. And we hope you do sign up for, let's say the winter semester. I think enrollment has already started. So maybe we'll see you on campus, and Tony will say hi if you're in his classes. Mm-hmm. And you can call him Tony because we said you could on WHFR, right?
Right.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Jack.
Thanks for being with us. So we're going to now listen to Jack Lessenberry's comments about the Electoral College. He thinks we should abolish it. And also what he calls tech fools that are hurting our democracy. And we'll be back. John and I will be back with more comments and stories about Dearborn and the surrounding area. WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. I've been a staunch defender of the Electoral College, that quaint mechanism left over from the early days of the Republic. You may well know how it works, though many people don't. When you voted for president last week, you in fact voted not for a candidate, but for a slate of 16 people who pledged to vote for that candidate. The winning electors will drive to Lansing on December 19th and cast their votes in longhand, as they would have in 1792. In every state except Maine and Nebraska, the winner of the popular vote gets all that state's electoral votes. Based on how the states voted, Donald Trump will then be formally elected by a vote of 306 to 232. But here's the problem with that. Far more people actually voted for Hillary Clinton. She currently has a lead of about 700,000 votes, and there are still millions left to count, mostly in the overwhelmingly Democratic states of Washington and California. When it's all over, she may have won by more than 2 million. In other words, the popular will is being thwarted because of something left over from a time when the founders wanted a set of wise men to pick a president for us. These days, most of the electors are party activists who are given the symbolic honor as a reward for service. These aren't a group of political philosophers, and no one wants them to debate the merits of the candidates. One of the Republican electors is a convicted felon who served 4 years in federal prison. They're just supposed to show up and vote. For way more than a century, the electoral vote was always won by the winner of the popular vote. In fact, it usually magnified the margin of the winner and added legitimacy to his presidency. Ronald Reagan, for example, got 51% of the popular vote in 1980, but more than 90% of the electoral vote. But now things have changed. We've had two cases in 16 years in which the winner came out the loser. Thanks to the fact that most states are safe for one party, it's become far more likely that the electoral result won't mirror the popular one. Also, virtually all campaigning is taking place in a tiny handful of swing states. Trump might have campaigned in California if this was about winning approval from more citizens. You might think I'm saying this because I'm a liberal, and both candidates who lost while winning were Democrats, but that's not the case. We had almost the opposite happen in 2004. George W. Bush won overall by 3 million popular votes, but he would have lost in the Electoral College had John Kerry taken Ohio. Changing the Constitution by amendment would be difficult and take years. But there's also something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. This is an agreement among the states that they will assign their electors to whichever candidate wins the national popular vote. This would only kick in, however, when enough states have joined the compact to guarantee a majority. Michigan legislators should immediately sign us up. This would restore some legitimacy to our presidential elections. And after this year, that's something we certainly need.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. Yesterday, we learned that the Detroit News is inviting every editorial employee, from the most junior reporter to the executive editor, to quit their jobs. If you work there and you decide to voluntarily walk the plank, they'll give you 1 week's pay for every year you work there, up to half a year. That's not a very good offer as buyouts go. A year ago, a friend of mine who'd been a news columnist for many years was offered a year's pay to quit. The writers and editors have a week to decide whether to take it, and then, if not enough people walk the plank, their current owner, Digital First Media, will start laying people off. They haven't said how many bodies they need to throw over the side. The announcement was greeted with gloom by those who understood what a loss this is for the community, and derision from those who see newspapers as essentially an obsolete 19th-century business that's only hanging on out of nostalgia. We need a name for people who think like that, I call them techno-fools. Yes, daily newspaper circulation is less than half what it was in the 1970s. Advertising revenue has declined accordingly. Something like only one out of every five households now gets a newspaper delivered every day. Clay Shirky, a well-known writer who specializes in technology, said recently, "Society doesn't need newspapers. What we need is journalism." Well, fine. But even today, in their much diminished state, newspapers are producing the vast majority of the quality content we call journalism. Michigan Radio is the best and deepest broadcast news operation in the state. But our news director, Vince Duffy, will be the first to admit that his staff can't possibly completely cover Ann Arbor or Grand Rapids or Flint, let alone Ada or Flushing or Chelsea. What's happened to newspapers is very simple. They are mainly supported by advertising, and vast amounts of it have fled to the Internet, often the sites like Craigslist, where ads are free. Newspapers do sell online ads, but customers are willing to pay only a fraction of what they did for print. Newspapers have instituted paywalls to try and get customers to pay to read their articles online, but many people resent this and refuse. They think they can get by with Google News instead, which operates much like a bird that steals other birds' eggs out of their nests. They take stuff largely from free newspapers, hurting them further. Newspaper journalism is not perfect, but it is collected according to professional standards that stress verification and accuracy, something that can't be replaced by egomaniacs or ideologues ranting on blogs. The result is a vast increase in ignorance. Macomb County, the state's third largest, is dreadfully underserved in terms of local journalism. Perhaps as a result, voters last week elected a county clerk who didn't campaign, refuses to pay her property taxes, and whose house is in foreclosure. Newspaper journalism has long been the main institution keeping an eye on those running government and society. Nobody has yet come up with a viable alternative, which means that informed democracy is dying, no matter how many really cool disaster pictures you can find on your smartphone.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
We thank Michigan Public Radio for allowing Jack Lessenberry to put a podcast that anybody can listen to, michiganradio.org, a great news source and opinion source, too, from people like Jack Lessenberry, who's also on the faculty, journalism faculty down at Wayne State University. A couple of events going on and one coming up. Currently, we're in the last week of the Children's Theater presentation of Charlotte's Web. That's right. We're doing a production on the stage, live on a stage in a theater, and there's public performances that continue through November 20th. So tonight at 7 p.m., tomorrow at 2 and 7, and Sunday at 2 p.m., they'll be giving these performances, and it's perfect for the whole family. Tickets are $10 for adults and $5 for children 12 and under. I'm going to try to get my granddaughter to go with me this weekend to catch it. It's the last weekend where it's possible. If you don't know the story, I don't know where you've been, but it's a famous novel by E.B. White with pictures, you know, children's novel. And the story is that Charlotte the Spider saves Wilbur by writing words in her web. All the barnyard animals work together to protect him, especially when he's taken to the county. Wilbur's a pig, I believe, to the county fair, where they must meet even more challenges. Finally, everyone realizes how special Wilbur really is. And so all performances take place in the McKenzie Fine Arts Center in the Adrae Auditorium, right here on the main campus at 5101 Evergreen Road, Henry Ford College. Tickets can be purchased in advance by going to their website, which is theater, spelled T-R-E, the fancy way. That's not incorrect. Theater, T-H-E-A-T-R-E, .hfcc.edu. And they're also available at the door. And if you want more information or group rates, you can call 313-845-9817. That's Charlotte's Web last weekend here at the Adrae Auditorium, McKenzie Fine Arts Center, Henry Ford Campus, College main campus. So tonight again, 7 p.m., tomorrow at 2 and 7 p.m., and last performance to the public, Sunday at 2 p.m. Hope you can make it over here. It's going to be a great, fun experience for the whole family. What a great thing to do before Thanksgiving hits. Charlotte's Web. And by the way, it's a great musical score that is done by one of our talented musicians, artist here at Henry Ford College, Anthony Lay, and it's absolutely amazing, I understand. So there's music, a little bit of dancing and on stage, and just a great story, a classic children's story. So come on over and see Charlotte's Web at Henry Ford College this weekend, last chance. Also, we're having a adjunct faculty fair. It's sort of a job fair to get more teachers here, part-time teachers that are called adjuncts, fancy name for part-time. You know, colleges these days run with a majority of their teachers being adjuncts in order to save money, since the state of Michigan is not kicking out what it used to, and Michigan is one of the least supported of all higher education state institutions in the whole country. They're the state least, I think we're the 48th out of 50 in terms of giving money to our colleges to keep them running and to give them what they need. And so you got to save money wherever you can. Well, if someone has the right master's degree in the subject area or has other related and or has other related background in a number of areas here at the college, we need you to teach classes. And maybe some people who have these advanced degrees didn't even think of that possibility or that we needed help. And so this is next Wednesday, November 30th, from 11 in the morning to 4 p.m. right on campus. And get all the questions answered and even get your interviews with these various areas. So where do we need help? American Sign Language teachers, anatomy and physiology, teachers in Arabic language, astronomy, automotive technology, ASE certified people we need for that, biology, chemistry, CNC gauging and inspection. Sorry, I don't know what the CNC stands for. But if you do, maybe you're ready to teach here at Henry Ford College. Computer-aided design systems, also known as CAD. Computer information systems, CIS. Electrical manufacturing maintenance. English composition, always need teachers of English. Important class, a lot of sections. English Language Institute, that's where they teach English to people who don't speak English as a native language. French language teachers, fluid power, machine tool, master KMNC, mathematics teachers, mechanical manufacturing maintenance, medical insurance specialists, physics engineering teachers, respiratory therapists, sociology, Spanish language, and even, I don't know why I said even, welding. Well, you don't want uneven welding. No, that would be bad. That will crack after a while. So even is a correct word. So all those areas. So the adjunct faculty job fair is free and open to the public. I'm just thinking that maybe somebody working on a master's or graduating, going to start a master's degree, maybe they hadn't thought about teaching. You know, if they can't get a job in industry or something, maybe they'd want to teach even part-time as a supplement to whatever their day job is. And so wouldn't be bad to come over and even to talk to people, even if you don't have the right credentials yet. Maybe you will in a couple of years. Or some people can get a master's in 1 year, I think, in fact. So, and that might be enough to get you right into the flow of teaching in a college institution. I've only taught here for 48 years now, and I can only say good things about the college, the campus, the administration. And you'll find out a lot more at that job fair. And it's a week from this coming Wednesday. It's November 30th, and it's on campus in our Andrew Mazzara ASCC building. It's right on the front of the campus, main campus here, 5101 Evergreen Road, south of Ford Road, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. No registration necessary in advance and free and completely open to the public. Also, before we get back to the local news, we missed it by one day, but yesterday, November 17th, was National Black Cat Day. And I often mention that. John was surprised here. I hadn't heard about that one, huh, John?
No, sir.
But here's some quirky things about black cats. First of all, I do this because, yes, I have a cat of my own. So I guess I'm a cat person. I like cats in general. Okay, and they like me, let me tell you. But I only have one right now. But black cats have a problem getting adopted at animal shelters. People think they're spooky or superstitiously evil or something, and they have a real problem getting it. Don't do that, folks. Black cats are cats. Duh. You know, don't blame them for the color of their fur, okay? And here's some well, they're mostly missed, but here's some little-known facts. Well, they're actually little-known facts. Okay. Number one, looking for a romance? Surround yourself with black cats. There's nothing wrong with being a black cat lady. In Japan, young women are encouraged to own a black cat to increase their chances of romance. So black cats are not only great companions, but also fantastic wing cats.
Uh-huh.
Again, that's just because of the culture in Japan, but still, it's interesting. And in some countries, black cats are actually considered good luck, not bad luck. In Great Britain, black cats are thought to bring good luck, while in Germany, if a black cat crosses your path from the right, it's said to bring prosperity. So we love that. That's money. So, and it doesn't say what they, if they cross your path from the left, what happens. But anyway, point number three here. Black cats developed dark hair for a reason. Research shows that black cats may have developed dark hair to fight off disease, meaning their fur is more than beautiful. It's useful, too. Okay. Number four, black cats can rust in the sun due to a special pigment called melanin in their fur. When out in the sun, many black cats will temporarily turn a dark brown color as if they were rusting. Doesn't hurt them, I guess.
I wonder if melanin is any relation to melatonin.
I don't think so, nope. But anyway. Although we have melanin in our skin, too, yes, some people to more or less, and that's one reason we have skin colors as humans. Yeah. Last point here, black cats almost always have yellow eyes because they have an excess of melanin. Oh, we mentioned that. A pigment that causes dark coloration. Coincidentally, melanin also causes their irises to be yellow. Seems a contradiction in terms there, but I think that's a nice combination. If you get a yellow car, you should have a black interior, maybe vice versa, but they don't have yellow interiors. I don't think they do that. But
I had a yellow Mustang with a black interior, so there you go.
Well, there you are. It's not impossible. Yeah, and I think that's a great combination, by the way. But I just want to say that just because I am a friend of the animal shelter, which is now the Friends for Metro Detroit Animals in Dearborn, and their new facility, which is one of the stories we didn't cover last week. They have announced in the paper 2 weeks ago that they're going to start construction. Now, it's a $5.7 million center, but they've raised $4.7 million. So they've got $1 million to go, but they certainly can start building it. So they still need donations, but it's going to be a wonderful facility. It's going to be in the location where the old train station in Dearborn was, mm-hmm. on Michigan Avenue, more to the east side of town or in the Midtown area. So there's a picture in the Press and Guide from November 9th on the cover, or the artist drawing. It's going to be a great facility. The current facility is hazardous to the health of the animals and the workers there for one reason or another. Interesting point. And so they're doing a great job. They almost never euthanize, that is, kill any of the animals. They always get them out for adoption or to a foster home. Mm-hmm. And they're doing a great, great job. So that's great news that the new center will begin. And, of course, they're still taking contributions, which are tax deductible, I want to mention. So if you want to help out the animals, including the black cats, check out the Friends for the Detroit area animals. Okay. John, I know you'll have some gross eel stories, but just a minute. Let me just go through the papers here and catch up. Okay. Let's see. I can't remember if I mentioned. I don't think I did. Maybe I did. But Lauren Plawecki, who was the daughter of the late legislator out in Julie Plawecki in the 11th District, Dearborn Heights mostly, she did get elected to represent that district, but only until the end of this year, because that was the rest of the term. But the person who did get elected, and it's a big, long story of how these things work out legally, but the person who did get elected is a former councilman from Inkster, Jewel Jones. That's Jewel with double L. He's only 21. And Lauren wasn't able to run for that. Well, she wasn't able to run because the Democratic Party didn't choose her to run.
Yes.
It was one of those behind doors sort of thing.
Smoke-filled room kind of thing, you know?
Right. And by the way, the young Plawecki, she's actually a year older than Jewel. No disrespect. I'm not being ageist, but imagine the extra maturity of one year. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
No, of course, that's a joke. He's already proven himself, I guess, on the Inkster console, and he won quite handily over, like, 2-1 over his, almost more than 2-1 over his Republican challenger, and is going to get a salary of $72,000 a year. That's what they pay representatives to Lansing from this area. Jones, by the way, is in his senior year at the U of M Dearborn, pursuing a degree in political science.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Remember Dave Kinesic? We had him on the show.
Yes.
He was elected from the Dearborn Heights area. And after serving in the military, he came back and he got a degree in political science at U of M Dearborn. So, so political science, stressing the science thing there,
yeah,
doesn't hurt as a basis for learning about politics, but also as a way to be a good politician, I think. You're not just getting into it to mess up the system, as some people have said. You know, let's shake up the system. I'm not going to give any connection there to any particular candidate or voters, but you know, I'm just saying they know about the system. They want to do good. And so congratulations, unfortunately, only temporarily to Lauren Plawecki, but I'm sure she'll do whatever she can in the so-called lame duck session in Lansing. And Joel Jones, will also a Democrat, will be in that seat starting in January. Okay, let's see. Oh, my goodness, only 5 minutes to go. I don't think there's any other big story in that paper. One more to look at, yes. And Kitty Love is going to mention this on her show, so I'll leave the story behind. But first-time filmmakers are have created a music documentary about local Detroit area musicians. Right. And it's got people like Benny Spear from Benny and the Jets, that John, personal friend of and seen many times perform, as well as Howard Glazer, who was in a picture with the filmmaker there, and other Dearborn Heights residents and area musicians are in this. It is produced, written, and directed by Dearborn Heights residents Lisa Hagopian and also Eric Harabadian. And it's called Nothing But Music. It premieres November 20th, and I'll let Kitty Love read the story if she wants to and say more about the event at the Token Lounge this Sunday, where the film is going to premiere. John? You got time for a story or two? We already covered one of them that you were going to mention, I see.
Yes. Well, come one and come all to the Token Lounge. It should be a very fine documentary, according to Benny. Tonight, we also want to put a little bit of support for the Joe's Top Dog Jazz Friday. Mm-hmm. Mary Slavin is singing tonight with the trio, with the Rich Michaels Trio. They will be closed for Thanksgiving, so come on out and have a good time.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
We have started a Saturday evening music program at Smokey's on the River on Gross Hill.
On Gross Hill, okay.
And last Saturday we had Benny perform that
oh,
night.
Okay.
And tomorrow night we have Barry Von England, who is a local guitar and singer. And
when you say on the river, is that like on the east side of the island or the west side?
It's on the,
what's the west, road?
The West River.
West River. Yep. Oh, okay, west side. So, okay.
Yep, west side of the river, across from the old...
yeah, use the bridge, don't swim over.
But, that's right. Yep.
Okay, but Smokey's Lounge. Okay, another great venue thing. And they're all great if they have local live musicians, and we support the cause here at WHFR as much as possible. So I have another number of opinions from people, big and small, from New York Times, Michael Moore, all the way down, Jack Lessenberry, some things he didn't say in the recorded moments. But I'd just like to read this one from the Downriver. Actually, it's in the Press and Guide now, too, pressandguide.com opinion page. And it's from a young woman. Her name is Chelsea Liddy. And the title of her editorial comment is, or opinion comment is, this duck is not lame. You know, I mentioned the lame duck session in Congress in the next few months, and she said, this duck is not lame. By the way, she's a co-coordinator of the Calmeek.com, as I say it, which is the women's comic group, creating comics. There's story and there's character drawing, there's coloring, all involved in the process of women's comics, and she's one of the coordinators of that. But she's a local resident, and this is what she has to say. And she is, okay, she's a liberal, and the question for a lot of liberals is, what do I do now? And this is what she has to say. She says, let's get this out of the way. As a woman, as the fiancée of an Eastern European immigrant, as a friend and ally of Muslim Americans, African Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos, LGBTQ individuals, disabled individuals, and as someone who works in Dearborn to advance justice for marginalized communities every single day, I am absolutely disgusted by our nation's election of Donald Trump as the next president. I told you she was a liberal. You could have expected that. But wait, just listen to what she says. However, after mourning, going through denial, despairing, and eating a bunch of pasta at Roman Village, I was inspired by President Barack Obama's move to make Planned Parenthood funding permanent through Title X, and I decided to take positive action. Today, and she wrote this on November 10th, 2 days after the election, I launched the, and this is hashtag 70 Days, 70 Actions campaign. That's a Facebook thing, right? Hashtag? Okay. Hashtag 70 Days, 70 Actions campaign. Every day from now until January 20th, 2017, I'm going to share a picture or a video of myself taking political action offline. The actions I'm talking about include calling our elected officials, taking it to the streets to attend hashtag not my president rallies, donating to progressive organizations like the ACLU, joining my local Democratic Party chapter, calling for election and party reform, combating Nestle's request to pump even more water from a Michigan spring for free while Flint residents suffer. What's that called? Is it Ice Mountain? Ice Mountain water, folks, comes from an aquifer in northern Michigan, and they're making a fortune off that water, and they're not giving much back to Michigan, and Nestle owns it. There's some other things I could say about Nestle, but not time for that today. And she says also she's going to be opposing, this is again the statement by Chelsea Liddy, opposing the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, that's in Dakota, of course, North Dakota, and generally raising hell. Whatever she means by that. This is beyond sharing articles online or signing petitions. Facebook is one tool. Let's use our whole arsenal. And she doesn't mean weapons, I'm sure. She says, as my first action, I called the Democratic National Committee today in order to register my disappointment and anger concerning their collusion around Hillary Clinton, as well as the party's mistreatment regarding Senator Bernie Sanders, regardless of polls favoring a Sanders win against Trump, which they did. They didn't pay attention to that. Those many, many polls that said he would beat Trump. For the first time in recent memory, the clear and obvious candidate of young people was not the choice of the Democratic Party establishment, and it failed, which is a major red flag. After the first 70 days, we have 2 years to figure out how to flip the House, flip the Senate, and in Michigan, figure out which progressive candidate is going to replace Governor Rick Snyder. That's 2018. In November, it happens. Our progressive values are standing on the world stage. Our protection of the planet and the future of our kids are at stake. Please join me. There's a lot we can do, and we will not go quietly into the night. As the character Gandalf says in The Return of the King, she has to use a fantasy story here because that's her, some of her background, by J.R.R. Tolkien, quote, Gandalf, courage will now be your best defense against the storm that is at hand. No, my heart will not yet despair, unquote. So she concludes by saying, let's take courageous action. Who's with me? There you go. And that's the opinion of Chelsea Liddy, Dearborn resident, women's rights activist. Yeah. However, that's kind of what Anthony Perry early in the hour said, too. You need to get involved, even if Republicans supporting Trump and they want to continue to advise him and the people they elected to go the path that they expect them to go from their campaign statements. Yeah. Do that. Don't just say, oh, okay, I voted for you. Now go ahead and do what I expect, and I'll check back in 4 years. That's not the way to have democracy. You know, you've got to keep track of these people, and you've got to do everything you can think of